You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Farah.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. Coming up, a Wisconsin researcher shares new information about how much air conditioning impacts pollution levels.
First, in the early days of President Trump's presidency, stories of immigration raids from Immigration and Customs Enforcement dominated the headlines. The number of deportations that have taken place since Trump took office aren't clear, but his stance on immigration has been enough to unsettle undocumented immigrants nationwide.
That's having an impact on states like Wisconsin, where the dairy industry relies on the labor of immigrants. Nationally, almost half of all dairy workers are immigrants, and experts estimate that almost three-quarters of them are undocumented.
Based on our next guest's reporting, anti-immigrant sentiment since Donald Trump was elected has created fear among undocumented dairy workers in Wisconsin, and some are deciding to leave the country out of fear of deportation.
Alexandra Hall is a reporting fellow for WPR and the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism. You can read her piece about this issue on the Central Time Facebook page. Alex, welcome back.
Thank you.
Well, you reported on a group of workers, included an entire family, who were getting ready to leave a farm in Wisconsin to go back to Mexico. Can you tell us what they said about why they made this choice to leave?
I guess I should start by saying that, you know, judging from the conversations that I've had with workers on mainly on farms in Buffalo and Pepin counties in the western part of the state, a lot of them say that, you know, we had always planned on going back eventually, that the plan was to come over here, work for a few years, send back money to our families, and then eventually move back to Mexico. And I think that since the current administration, first of all, while Donald Trump was campaigning and now that he's in office, a lot of the rhetoric that's coming out of the White House, now they're in a situation where they're weighing the pros and cons of staying in the country and seeing what happens, or preemptively deciding to go back in advance of anything that could potentially happen. And so, you know, they're weighing the pros and cons and they're saying, you know, we were planning on going back someday. Is that day today? And that was the case with the Hernandez family.
And Miguel Hernandez had a big role on this farm, this dairy farm in Wisconsin. And he left, and you reported on that departure with his wife and his family. This is what he had to say about why the presidency of Donald Trump was a factor in making him and his family decide to leave.
Because he promised he's going to deport all the people who wasn't legal in the country and stuff. Like, our bosses always told us, don't worry, because he's not going to do anything. But in some states, it's happening.
So in terms of the mood on the farms with the workers that you spoke to, have they seen a change since the election of Donald Trump?
Yes. So we actually met this family when we were reporting a story in March on the Wisconsin dairy industry's reliance on undocumented immigrant labor on dairy farms. And we were introduced by an interpreter to several different workers and families on different farms in this area. And we met Luisa Topole, who's Miguel Hernandez's wife. And she said that she was terrified that she was going to be grabbed by ICE at Walmart, that she would be separated from her children. And that, you know, she described several experiences of hostility towards her and her family in public and her local community. She mentioned an incident where, you know, her husband and another worker were at a gas station, and this was shortly after Trump was elected, and someone made a comment about Mexicans in a derogatory sense, and it was very clearly aimed at them. And so, yeah, I think that they are experiencing a difference. And it also has a lot to do with the media. I heard a lot of people talking about just how closely they're watching the news with, you know, these sanctuary city bills that we're seeing in states like Texas, similar situations that we've seen with Arizona in past years, and kind of like waiting to see if this is going to happen in Wisconsin. As we know, it hasn't happened yet, but just that uncertainty has really put them on edge.
Are the fears that Louisa and others described to you, are they grounded in fact? Are there increased deportations that we're seeing in specifically in Midwestern states?
That's a good question. I guess the short answer is we don't know. The data paints an incomplete picture. We do know that in the first 100 days of the Trump presidency, that nationwide and in the six-state Chicago region, which includes Wisconsin, that arrests have gone up. We also know that nationally, deportations have gone down. And so, you know, there often is a lag between arrest and deportation, and that can be for a number of reasons. If someone contests their deportation, if they stay in detention, if they get out on bond, if they have a prior order of removal, if they have a criminal history, all of that can lead to a gap between before ultimate deportation. And, you know, we also do know that in the last fiscal year that the backlog of immigration cases has gone up 100,000 cases, and that those are most of them are for people who have had immigration violations, not actually have committed crimes. So that's what the data is showing us, what's actually happening, which is completely separate from the rhetoric that we're hearing. And I think that, you know, regardless of is it actually happening, it's the fear that's motivating people to kind of say, like, you know, well, let's look at whether or not it's worth it for us to continue to live here. If it's really this hard, if we're so afraid to go to the grocery store and being pulled over and asked about our immigration status or anything like that, it's really the fear.
And Louisa and Miguel, they have children that lived here in Wisconsin. Did it seem like those children considered Wisconsin home or Mexico? And what about the families as a whole as they lived here for so many years?
Yeah, I think that at least in the Hernandez family, the kids feel American. Their oldest son, Thomas, just finished preschool, was supposed to go into kindergarten next year. And, you know, I think that he's young enough where, as Miguel says in our story, that, you know, he kind of has a sense of what's going on, but he's young enough where it won't be completely traumatizing to just pick up and move to a new country. But, you know, I do know that keeping the family together and also considering what impact it has on your children when they've partially grown up in the United States is definitely a factor that these families are taking into consideration. That's one of the main reasons that the Hernandez family decided to leave now rather than wait and see if things change politically. At the same time, you know, when we were there, I spoke with Miguel's brother, and he has been in the United States for 18 years. He has four U.S.-born children, two of whom are in middle school at this point. And, you know, he seemed really concerned, and especially because he was thinking, you know, now my brother's leaving. All these other people are talking about leaving. When will it be my turn to leave? At this point, I don't think I can because the adjustment would be just too difficult for my kids.
We're talking with Alex Hall right now, a reporting fellow for WPR and the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism, talking about her new piece looking at the recent departures of some immigrants from dairy farms where they were employed here in Wisconsin. And you also spoke with a farm owner, Doug Konepke, who employs farmers like Miguel and Louisa. And here's what he had to say about them leaving.
I don't know where the industry would be right now without them. You know, we're relying on it and what it does for Wisconsin and our economy and that. I don't know where it'll be. They better do something, though. They better do something because they're leaving. You see it right here. They're packing up.
So can you tell us a little bit what brought workers like Miguel Hernandez to Wisconsin in the first place?
Well, I think that they were attracted by an industry that is hungry for labor. You know, the dairy industry is unique in the sense that dairy farmers can't just apply for temporary agricultural visas for guest workers to come from other countries, because the only visa that we have, I guess the only visa that would be applicable to them is the H-2A visa, which is for temporary seasonal work in agriculture. But dairy is a year-long process. You have to keep cows milked 24 hours a day, three times a day, 365 days a year. And so, you know, there was a comment that Miguel's brother made to me as well, that he said, you know, it's strange and it's difficult, almost uncomfortable, that, you know, we know that in Wisconsin, voters really, you know, came out to the polls in support of Donald Trump. And this is the place where they hire us the most. Most of the workers I've spoken to, after they cross the border, they've worked in other states. They've worked in Oregon, Georgia, California, all these other states where agriculture is really big. But they ultimately came to Wisconsin because a friend or a family member from Mexico was already here and said, if you want a job, come to Wisconsin, because they really need people. And in conversations that I've had with farmers, you know, most people say, at least in western Wisconsin, that around 2000 or so, there was a labor shortage. And that around that same time period, Mexican immigrants came in and started, you know, filling these jobs. And it's a really good arrangement for dairy farmers because they need that help. And workers from Mexico are here to work. So they come in and, you know, even like Doug Konepke and other farmers would tell me, you know, it was years before I could even talk them into taking one day off work. You know, they're here to work, and then that's pretty much it. They're not looking to spend their time hanging out.
And in the case of Doug Konepke and that farm, it sounds like he worked pretty hard to try to convince the Hernandez family to stay.
Right, he did. You know, for the years that Miguel and Luisa were living in a home together with their children, there were other workers there who lived in the house with them. This is a house that Doug lived in before. It's right next to the farm. It's so close to the day-to-day operations of the farm that you can actually hear Mexican cumbia music playing in the milking parlor from the family's back door. So, I mean, they are on the farm in the midst of the energy of the farm all day, every day. And when Miguel said that he was going to leave, his supervisors, he says, offered him more money. They offered him, you know, we'll get a trailer and get the other guys to live in there. You can live in this house with your family alone. And he just said, you know, now is the time for me to leave. And that was because of a number of factors. You know, it's the issue of deportation. It's also, you know, his father is ill. And I think that he really had to make a hard choice in terms of, you know, does it make more sense to stay here and keep sending money back to our family and settle down in the U.S.? Or, you know, what kind of moments are we missing out on with our families in Mexico while we stay here?
And Alex, as we wrap up, Wisconsin Senator Ron Johnson introduced some legislation back in May that would allow states to set up their own guest worker visa programs. What kind of role could that potentially play in the situations we're talking about, in helping dairy farmers, for instance, retain immigrant workers?
So that proposal is for having states decide what kind of guest worker visas they have, and so that they can mold it to the agriculture that's most prominent in their state. And it makes a lot of sense that a senator from Wisconsin would propose that, since we have such an issue with dairy in our state. I think that, you know, I mean, if they did allow temporary agriculture workers, as Doug Konepke told me when we were reporting the story, he said, you know, they do it for ball players, they do it for all these other industries. Why can't they just allow workers from Mexico or other countries to come in, work during our busy season, which is right now? That's why he's having a really hard time with the Hernandez family leaving. Have them come in, work, and then they can easily go back, see their families, and then come back again when we need the help.
Alex, thanks so much for joining us.
Yeah, absolutely.
That was Alex Hall. She's reporter for WPR and the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism. She joined us to talk about some of Wisconsin's undocumented dairy workers who are choosing to leave the country. Well, scientists have known for a long time that levels of air pollution were higher on hot days. The exact connection wasn't always that clear, but new research out of UW-Madison explains the connection more clearly and offers valuable information to states and municipalities that are trying to address the problem.
Tracy Holloway was the lead researcher on that study. She's a professor in the Nelson Institute for Environmental Studies and the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences at UW-Madison. Tracy, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you. It's really a pleasure to be here.
So this was something we knew, right? Air pollution higher on hot days. So what kind of causes and effects were we looking at there?
Yeah, we know that we have the highest levels of ground level ozone or smog on the hottest summer days. And there's this big question of what exactly is causing that, because ozone is not directly emitted. It cooks up in the atmosphere. So we've known for a long time that that cooking up process is affected by chemical reactions that depend on temperature. We've also known that some of the ingredients that go into the ozone recipe are temperature dependent. For example, there's a chemical called volatile organic compounds, or VOCs, that actually come from trees and plants. And on hot days, trees and plants emit more of these VOCs. Couple that with the fact that you have more sunlight often on hot days and often lower winds, it's a complex recipe. So our study added to this puzzle by looking at a piece that had not really been very well studied. In particular, that on hot days, we have people using more air conditioning and the power plants are cranked up to their, you know, pretty close to maximum on these hot days. So you have more pollution going into this already chemically active atmosphere.
We'll dig more into that air conditioning story in a moment, but I want to talk about what's at stake a little. We get air quality days. We usually get them in the summer, and this is something with real health consequences for people.
Yeah, absolutely. Ground level ozone has been linked with premature mortality, asthma incidences, and a lot of different adverse health outcomes, from heart disease to eye irritation. In fact, at high enough ozone levels, it even degrades rubber. And even at pretty low ozone levels, you see decreases in crop yields. So this is public health is driving control of ground level ozone, but it's certainly not the only bad outcome of ozone smog.
Let's take this a step at a time. Now, the temperature goes up. More people, me included, reach for the AC and turn it on. And when we flip the switch, we think, oh, it's just one house. It's not making a big difference. How much does our air conditioning use really affect the amount of electricity a community uses?
Yeah, so the sensitivity of overall electricity generation to air conditioning use, first of all, depends on how much of the overall electricity load is controlled by buildings. Here in Wisconsin, we use electricity for manufacturing. We use it for agricultural processes. These don't really depend on air conditioning. In fact, in general, about 60% of energy in Wisconsin, electricity in Wisconsin, is somehow tied to building use. But even within the buildings, we're using it for a lot of different things, for the lights and the TVs and the refrigerators. So there's this question of how much is coming from the air conditioning specifically. We found that in Wisconsin, for every increase in degrees Celsius, which is more or less 2 degrees Fahrenheit, you get about a 3.5% increase in electricity demand and electricity generation. This is in line with what we see across the United States. Some states have a higher sensitivity, some are a little bit lower, and it's often driven by what fraction of the state's electricity goes to buildings.
And now you've got that increase in electricity use. How much does a percentage increase like that affect pollutants that are in the air?
Yeah. So we've known for a long time that hot days drive electricity generation. This is known. But this question of how does that translate into air pollution is one of the new parts of our study. And it depends on where a state is getting its electricity from, and also where are there kind of fewer, older, dirtier power plants just come on from time to time? So actually, in Wisconsin, our sensitivity of air pollution to temperature is a little bit less sensitive than the national average, because we use a lot of electricity for a lot of stuff. So the step increase when we turn on the AC is about 2.5% for nitrogen oxides, for example, per degree Celsius. What we found that was surprising is that oftentimes in the U.S. states that have the lowest overall air pollution emissions, these are the states that have the highest sensitivity to the temperature. For example, states in New England that are may have very low emissions in general, but on the hottest days turn on some older power plants with dirtier fuels and less emission controls.
and talk about the kinds of pollution that are then emitted, say, in those older, dirtier coal plants, or maybe even newer ones, and how they play into that ozone story.
Yeah. So nitrogen oxides are the ingredient from power plants that really contributes to the ground-level ozone. That is really the hook. Mm-hmm. NOx, as we call it, cooks up with volatile organic compounds and forms ozone. Other pollutants that come from power plants form other types of air pollution issues. In particular, sulfur dioxide cooks up in the atmosphere to form fine particulate matter, which also has similar health impacts. But when we're talking about ozone on these really hot days, the pollution that we're really zooming in on is nitrogen oxides.
So there's the story. It gets hotter. We turn on our AC. We use more power. That puts out more of this pollutant. That means more ozone, and that can hurt our health. What lesson can we take away from this? What can we do about this?
Yeah, the good news is that this is something that is within our control. Many of the reasons that ozone is high on hot summer days are outside of our control. We can't change the chemistry of the atmosphere. We can't change what trees are doing. But we can look to beginning some of our peak electricity from cleaner sources. For example, solar energy often peaks on the hottest days of the summer. So the good news is that solar offers one opportunity to sidestep these peak electricity demand days. Another is just to pay attention to where air pollution is coming from, where electricity is coming from on these peak days in the Wisconsin and across the U.S., because these old power plants that may be dirtier may not be a problem on your typical day, but they may be a problem on the dirtiest days when you need controls the most.
Tracy, thanks a lot for sharing this research with us.
Thank you.
That's Tracy Holloway, professor in the Nelson Institute for Environmental Studies and the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences at UW-Madison. She was with us to share the results of new research looking at the connection between air conditioning use and rates of air pollution.
On June 17, 1972, several burglars were arrested at the office of the Democratic National Committee in the Watergate Hotel in Washington, D.C. In the following days, it was revealed that one of the intruders had connections to President Richard Nixon. What followed were months of investigations that ultimately led to Nixon's resignation.
In the 45 years since the scandal broke, it's become one of the most singular historic events in the country. The news catapulted two journalists to fame and led a president to ruin. But since the story broke that morning, a lot has changed and some myths have grown up in the media about the scandal.
W. Joseph Campbell joins us now. He's a professor in the School of Communication at American University and the author of several books, including Getting It Wrong, Debunking the Greatest Myths in American Journalism, and he's a former journalist. Joe, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you, Veronica. Thank you for having me back on your show.
Well, as we said, back on June 17th, 1972, 45 years ago, five men were apprehended breaking into the Democratic National Committee headquarters at the Watergate Hotel. How big a story was this at the time?
You know, it did make the front pages of some newspapers, including the Washington Post, but it wasn't a major national story. It wasn't a story that immediately touched off suspicions of widespread scandal in the Nixon administration. It was a story that was slow to percolate, slow to boil.
And how did the news begin to unspool and deepen in those first early days?
It began really as a police beat story, and the first report that the Washington Post published was under the byline of one of its police beat reporters. And it was through the police investigation, the D.C. police in the Capitol, where the unspooling of this scandal began. Some of the first linkages between the White House and the burglary were made at that very fundamental level, if you will, of law enforcement. And it was a couple of days afterwards when Woodward and Bernstein of the Washington Post had their first joint byline story together, in which they linked one of the burglars. Identified him as a security consultant to the Nixon reelection campaign, which was a strong tie to Nixon and his reelection.
What would you call the moment when, and maybe it's that moment, when it became clear that what the story was really the tip of the iceberg, the break-in and that first connection, and that this was something that was going to be a much bigger, all-consuming political story?
It probably wasn't until significantly later, and I'm almost tempted to say it wasn't until the summer of 1973 when it really became clear that this was a story of unprecedented dimensions, in both in political terms and in terms of a constitutional crisis. And that was the summer of the Watergate hearings, when the Senate Select Committee began to take testimony from people related to Nixon's administration, his reelection campaign, and began closing in, if you will, on the White House. It was then when the existence of Nixon's tapes, his secretly recorded audio tapes, tapes that he made of most of his conversations inside the White House, were disclosed. At least the existence was disclosed of those tapes. That really pivoted Watergate. That really pivoted the scandal to a chase for the tapes, because those tapes could, one way or another, determine the guilt or innocence of Nixon and his men. And in the end, they showed quite clearly that Nixon, within days after the break-in in June of 1972, had obstructed justice by ordering one of his aides to seek to divert the FBI's investigation into the Watergate burglary. And that was clearly a case of obstruction of justice. It was the so-called smoking gun tape that, when it was disclosed, when it was released finally in July and August of 1974, made very clear that Nixon would have to resign the presidency.
Now, you used the word unprecedented before. What was it about this political story that made it unlike anything that had come before it?
It was the first time. The scandal culminated in Richard Nixon's resignation, which was the first time a sitting U.S. president had ever been turned from office. He had to resign in the face of certain impeachment and conviction by Congress. And that alone is unprecedented, and that alone makes it a scandal without parallel. It was also the country's gravest political crisis and the gravest constitutional crisis of the 20th century. And that also, it makes this an exceptional moment in American history, exceptionally dark moment, if you will.
What was it the crux of those issues about politics and the Constitution? What were the questions that Americans and lawmakers were forced to confront then?
Just how close or how much evidence could we demand from the White House, from the executive branch? And Nixon was trying to resist many of the calls for him to release the tapes, to release transcripts of the tapes. He tried to satisfy those demands by partially releasing transcripts and portions of the tapes. But the demands for greater access to what the president had said and what he knew became kind of an unprecedented tug of war between the three branches of government. And finally, the Supreme Court resolved it by saying, you have to turn over that evidence. You have to turn over those tapes. And as I say, when he did, in the summer of 1974, his resignation, his departure from the White House became inevitable. But that was one example of the tug of war between the legislative, judicial, and executive branches of government.
We're talking with W. Joseph Campbell right now about the 45th anniversary of the Watergate scandal, which was on June 17th, 1942. W. Joseph Campbell is, 1972 rather, he's a professor in the School of Communication at American University in Washington, D.C. And Joe, what was the political atmosphere like at the time? Can you paint us a picture?
I'll try. In 1972, in the summer of 72, Richard Nixon was running for re-election, and his Democratic opponent was George McGovern. Nixon had, according to the polls at the time, a huge lead over McGovern, and McGovern was trying all kinds of efforts to catch up, to try to narrow the gap between he and Richard Nixon. But inevitably, that gap kept getting wider and wider, because Nixon was making efforts to draw down U.S. forces in Vietnam. The war in Vietnam was still going on, but it was on a lower simmer than it had been 4 or 5 years earlier. Nixon's also attempted to to present himself as a statesman, sort of above the political fray. There was an arms control agreement that was in the works with the Soviet Union at the time. So Richard Nixon was playing the international card, as well as the domestic card, to try to elevate himself above the political fray. And quite clearly, he had all the advantage of incumbency, and McGovern's campaign was a pretty shaky one. He had to replace his vice presidential candidates midstream. It was a really poorly run campaign, and McGovern tried on a number of occasions to call attention to the slowly emerging Watergate scandal, but without a whole lot of traction, without a whole lot of success. And in the end, Nixon won a huge landslide, a 49-state landslide re-election victory. And the political climate of the time was one of Nixon's inevitable re-election. And it's interesting looking back how Watergate really did not figure much in the campaign. It sort of got overwhelmed by the campaign coverage at the time. It was not a dominant or central issue of the 72 campaign.
By a lot of accounts, the politics were polarized at the time. Do you think that had something to do with both the election and the Watergate story getting buried, and also the very existence of that story, the fact that that was something that happened in American politics?
A lot of people had trouble believing, Veronica, whether that this was a scandal that would reach the White House or would be something that would have involved the president. It was characterized by Nixon's spokesman as a third-rate burglary, and at first many people just thought it was bizarre, and how was this going to eventually sweep up the president and his top aides, which it eventually did. But back in the summer and fall of 72, it was hard to see how that was going to be an outcome. And as I said, George McGovern, the Democratic candidate for president, was trying his darndest to try to make this an issue, but it just received almost no traction whatsoever. And it's hard to believe now, thinking back, that Watergate that scandal, as important as it was in American history, did not have much of an effect on the election. And it was not as tense or demanding or as riven. The country wasn't as riven in 1972 as it had been just 4 years earlier in 1968. I mean, that was a year that almost gave America a nervous breakdown. But by 72, the war in Vietnam was being, the U.S. forces from Vietnam were being withdrawn, and the war was not as pressing of an issue as it had been 4 years earlier, when Nixon narrowly won election over Hubert Humphrey.
W. Joseph Campbell is with us right now. We're talking about the 45th anniversary of the Watergate scandal. He's a professor in the School of Communication at American University in Washington, D.C.
You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. If you were around when the Watergate scandal is unfolding, how did it shape your view of American politics or American journalism? Did it seem like a big story to you at first, or were you surprised how much it grew as it went on? If you weren't around at the time, how have you thought of the Watergate scandal? What questions do you have? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll continue our conversation in just a bit here on Central Time.
This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferrer.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. We're continuing our conversation about the 45th anniversary of the Watergate scandal with W. Joseph Campbell. He is a professor in the School of Communication at American University in Washington, D.C., and the author of the book, Getting It Wrong, Debunking the Greatest Myths in American Journalism.
You can join the conversation now at 800-642-1234. What are your thoughts on the Watergate scandal? What impact do you think it had on politics over the last 45 years? What questions do you have about what happened? Are there lessons today for the world of politics, the world of journalism? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You could also post on the Central Time Facebook page.
And Joe, I want to ask you before we get to our callers, we live in a time now where politics are very polarized. There's a lot of, the word rancor is used a lot to describe the sentiment between the two parties, not a lot of bipartisan cooperation, a lot of cynicism to go along with all of that. Do you think some of that was birthed in the Watergate scandal?
I think it was, Veronica. I think it really does some of the rancor, some of the divisions in the country really do, some of the suspicions about government and the federal government in particular, I think a lot of that can be traced back to Watergate, to the Watergate era. At least it was incipient back then and has developed over the years. The Clinton scandal of the 1990s was another moment in which partisan rancor really deepened in this country, and I think that had a lasting effect as well. So there's certainly something to be said for the effects of Watergate, the long-lasting effects of Watergate on the American political psyche.
Let's take a caller now. We've got Jim joining us first in Suamico. Jim, hi.
Hello, how you doing?
Good, thanks.
I just wanted to say that, you know, basically in 72, yes, the Vietnam War was winding down, but it wasn't wound down completely. I was over there, Gulf of Tonkin and some rivers, and basically the North had invaded the South, so that was still going on, even though it wasn't a primary situation because the draft was pretty well wound down. But the other comment I'd like to make is that the journalism reporting back then was not quite as biased as I see it today, where you can turn from Fox News and get one side it consistently, and you turn to MSNBC and you get, or CNN or other channels and get primarily the other side, and that's all it is.
Jim, thanks a lot for sharing those points there. And Joe, he's making the point that the war had not quite wound down to the extent maybe that we think it had. But also, let's get at that last point that he thinks the state of journalism was different back then, that it took a more holistic approach and it wasn't as splintered. What do you think?
Well, it certainly wasn't as splintered. There were fewer platforms. There were, three major networks, and they were guided by what was then called the Fairness Doctrine, which really was a way to enforce fairness on the national news networks. And so the Fairness Doctrine really kept broadcasters, ABC, CBS, NBC, from taking decided points of view, from editorializing a lot on television. And so that was certainly true. And then the cable networks that we know today were not even in anyone's imagination back in 1972. And so, yeah, there's, I think a case can be made, although it's probably anecdotal rather than a detailed content analysis, that, yeah, it was probably less partisan, less riven, less consumed by controversies related to bias than it is today. Plus, social media, which is a real kindler of complaints against the mainstream news media, that was certainly not around in the early 70s either.
In some lights, this was seen as kind of a golden age of journalism, largely due to Woodward and Bernstein, who were lionized. And you say in some senses maybe we went too far in according them too much credit for cracking this case. Do you want to do a little myth busting there about what their role was?
Gladly, yes. The dominant narrative of Watergate over the years, over the 45 years, has become the notion that Woodward and Bernstein, through their dogged reporting of the scandal and with the help of a super secret source named Deep Throat, codenamed Deep Throat, effectively uncovered the crimes that forced Richard Nixon to resign the office of president. It's a nice, neat and tidy tale. It's a media-centric tale, so journalists tend to like this tale. But it really is not how Watergate was uncovered, and it was not how Watergate wound up. This has become a simplistic tale that is easily remembered, and it just erases almost all the details and almost all the complexities of Watergate, which, after all, was a scandal of crime, deceit, secret tapes, cover-ups. There was a lot going on in Watergate. It was a multidimensional, sprawling scandal. And many of the details and many of the names of the players have been forgotten over the 45 years. It's inevitable. History kind of works that way. You just kind of forget who did what and when. And in its place is this dominant narrative, this very straightforward, simplistic, media-centric narrative that Woodward and Bernstein brought down Nixon's corrupt presidency. And it's a way to grasp the essence of Watergate, if you will, that Nixon had to resign because of his misconduct. But it does not do justice to the many players and actors and forces and agencies that really had the central role of uncovering this scandal. And I'm thinking here of the FBI, federal prosecutors, special prosecutors, bipartisan panels of both houses of Congress, and ultimately the Supreme Court, which forced Nixon to turn over the incriminating tapes, the tapes that proved he was knee-deep or neck-deep in a cover-up of this crime. So the dominant narrative, the Woodward-Bernstein brought down Nixon narrative, is appealing, but it's inaccurate. And even the Washington Post, principals at the Washington Post over the years have dismissed this as the way Watergate was uncovered and unfolded.
You mentioned earlier that you saw this as a tug of war between the three branches of government that's played out over the course of this scandal. Do you ever do a little, you know, what the novelists do and think what would have happened if a certain branch would have caved or would have tugged and won that tug of war? Are there alternate endings
to Watergate?
Yeah, do you
there
think
would have been an alternate ending had there not been the audio tapes? Had Nixon not secretly tape recorded many of his conversations in the Oval Office and elsewhere in the White House, without those tapes, Richard Nixon probably escapes Watergate. He escapes as a wounded president, but he escapes and serves out his term. And so I think the tapes were really central, really decisive in terms of Richard Nixon's guilt or innocence, demonstrating that. And it really took that kind of certain evidence to make it very clear that he did commit high crimes and misdemeanors to be forced from office, because otherwise the evidence just wasn't there. It wasn't going to turn up in a in a convincing and compelling way, and so the tapes were essential to the outcome of Watergate.
In our last moments here, just a little bit of time left, are there lessons for how we should be covering a potential presidential law breaking today?
Well, I think persistence certainly is the key, and I think we've been seeing a lot of persistent reporting about President Trump and the suspicions about his collusion with Russia. But at the same time, I think we need to have more evidence than we've seen so far. I don't see there's much evidence, concrete evidence that links Trump or his campaign to collusion that had the effect of swinging the election his way. So far, that evidence, in my view, hasn't materialized. And I think to unseat a sitting president, one of the lessons of Watergate is that we really do have to have that persuasive, compelling, clear-cut evidence of misdemeanor or high crimes.
Joe, thank you so much for joining us.
Veronica, it's been my pleasure.
W. Joseph Campbell is a professor in the School of Communications at American University and the author of several books, including Getting It Wrong, 10 of the Greatest Misreported Stories in American Journalism, joining us today to talk about the 45th anniversary of the Watergate scandal and some of the myths surrounding it.